after a person had taken LSD, that the visual cortex, part of the brain that does visual cortex, starts to connect up with all these other parts of the brain that it is only weakly connected to normally. So it starts to, where the inference is that we start to send and receive more information, and that's where, and that correlated with the amount of hallucinations people have.
Hey everyone, this is Professor Grant Schofield, the author of What the Fat, and you're listening to My Kiwi Life with Will Fleming. To hear me and Will ponder a bit of life, download episode 1 on mykiwilife.com.
Hey friends, thanks for joining me on this week's episode of My Kiwi Life. If you're new to the show, hello, I'm doing a wave, sitting here doing a wave. Hugs to you guys who are joining for the first time. My Kiwi Life is a podcast where my name is Will Fleming, I sit down with people who are influencers. And what I mean by that, these are people who are looking for answers to questions we have that aren't so easy to find. You know, what does it mean to be happy? What does it mean to have a balanced life? How does that look like? So I try and find guests every week that can help me and help us answer that question. So that's basically My Kiwi Life. If you're a listener, thank you so much, everyone, for joining me again. I'm going to keep these intros short so we can get into this week's guest. And this week's guest is Dr. Suresh Muthukumaraswamy. And he is a psychedelics scientist. Say that fast. He's a scientist who is looking at the effects of psychedelics on the brain and what it does to us, and if there's any kind of health benefits or not. I mean, these questions are not answered because no one is studying this. So I like Dr. Suresh because he's getting in there and he's studying that stuff. I mean, ask yourself, how much do you really know about ketamine, LSD, and psilocybin? These are kind of words that I've heard in movies, but I've never really had much to do with them. So in this podcast, it's kind of like, I just want to sit down with a scientist and just unpack that for me. What does it look like when these things affect the human brain? Because here's my gut feeling, and I say it in the podcast, I feel like there's a reason tribes have used these type of substances for many years. I don't know what that reason is, but there's a reason, right? Because they wouldn't just do it for nothing. So I don't know, man. I feel like the Western culture is a little bit removed from all that stuff, and there's a bit of fear there, and these words drugs are really loaded. But I just want to have an open, balanced discussion about all these things, and if they're going to have any health benefits, then Dr. Suresh is one of the scientists who's going to find that. That's us. Let's get straight into this week's episode. Thank you to Podcasts New Zealand for all your support and guidance for My Kiwi Life, and everyone that listens, downloads, shares, you know, sends emails and messages. Honestly, this is perfect for me. So here we go with My Kiwi Life, episode number 30. We're racking them up, folks. Thank you very much. Hugs to you all. Enjoy this podcast.
My Kiwi Life, let's play the game of life today. My Kiwi Life, the ups and downs we live each day. This is my Kiwi Life. Oh, this is my Kiwi Life.
Basically, there's this idea that if you think of, just strip most of it away, what you're left with is generally in society, drugs are bad, and that's where the full stop happens. You know, a parent will say, don't get involved with that, that's going to be terrible. And I think they're right, but it does capture my mind when I think about tribes, and I think there must be a reason these tribes have had, you know, local, and what's the right word, ceremonies using these type of psychedelic drugs. And then I thought to myself, what are they getting out of it, you know? And so part of my podcast is to try and work out what are we getting out of it in everyday life, you know? What's life actually about? And when you analyze it from that, you start asking yourself things like, just again from my own perspective, you know, why are we here? What's the main goal? Why do I feel happy? Why do I feel sad? And so I think we're all trying to navigate through that kind of line. But then you break it down further, if you take the idea of being sad and depressed, and then you look at society, how I'm trying to think how we deal with that currently. And in New Zealand, it's, I think, terrible because
if you're a male, you're not taught to communicate and be open. If I think of my dad, he's that generation of man that you bottle it up, you know. So I think there's certainly room to work in New Zealand. That's why it excites me, these type of conversations. But I have to go into it gingerly, Suresh, because I don't know all your position on everything. So maybe that's a good start point to see exactly where you fit into these things I'm saying, and then we can just pick and extract from there.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned several hours of conversation there, I think. So I'm not quite sure where to start, but I think the first thing you did was you mentioned about sort of, okay, you were talking about drugs and how we approach drugs. And, you know, New Zealand actually has a very conservative approach to how we view drugs. We're very, I'll put it kindly, conservative. I won't use other words that I could.
Yeah.
We're backward in some ways.
Yes.
And, you know, and then there's touching on the idea potentially of these drugs as medicine, and is that outrageous? And when I always think about that, well, okay, take a step back and think, okay, opiates, morphine, absolutely essential that opiates are used as medicine, and they're used for treatment of pain, and it's, we have no problem with that. Now, of course, those drugs can be used recreationally and abused recreationally, and similarly with things like benzodiazepines to calm people down, or ketamine when it's used in anesthetics, you know, just absolutely essential medicines that we use. And so that medicines can be, that drugs can be used as medicines, but also be used on the other hand as recreational substances. So we shouldn't toss out the potential medicinal use of a compound just because it can and is recreationally abused. That doesn't mean it can't have some kind of medical purpose.
Yeah, and that's where I think we find ourselves as society tossing things out. You know, we kind of get to this point where there's just, and I probably should state, like, I grew up with this, like, no drugs around me. So I don't have a history of trialing things. My role was, as a boy, we lived in the country. So my dad said to me, you can have the car on the weekends, but you better not crash it or you can't get to your friends. So whenever that stuff was happening, I said, sorry, everyone, I'd love to try, but you want to get driven around or catch the bus type thing. So when I come into this conversation, I don't come in as pro or against, but I come in as an adult now and as someone who's trying to work this out, as why do we just cut cannabis off as, you know, blanket cut off? Why is it just thrown out, you know, like you were saying before?
I mean, I just to further, if you follow even that line of thought even further, not just why do we throw cannabis out, why do we even include alcohol? That's a drug, you know. It has terrible consequences when people drink too much, or and all the social problems that it causes, violence. I mean, you have to, only have to go to an emergency room on Saturday night to see all the problems it causes, the damage we do to each other by drinking the substance, but it's almost encouraged. So why there's this gray line? And when you're a scientist and you study how these I'm a scientist and I study how these compounds affect the brain and how they change brain chemistry. And when you think about it like that, there's the distinction on where we've drawn the line is completely arbitrary, and there's no rational sense to why one is legal and one is illegal from a sort of scientific perspective. But that's, as a society, we're not honest with ourselves because we don't acknowledge that we are kind of arbitrary. And I'm not saying that we should change the law, but I'm saying we should at least acknowledge that there is some just sort of completely arbitrary historical things that our society has implemented, rightly or wrongly, but we're probably more comfortable if we just stopped lying to ourselves as a society about
exactly
how these things work.
Well, especially if you think of things like alcohol and how it's used as this way to open up our society. I mean, look at any metropolitan area on Friday or Saturday, and I would argue that that's how Kiwis are interacting. We're waiting to take that drink so that it can take away some of this, you know, this, I don't know what it is in our culture, but, you know, you go to an All Black game and Kiwi fans don't get up and say, yeah, until they see everyone else doing it. You know, there's this idea that we're very reserved and we can't really show that side of us that's really proud. I mean, maybe we're getting better at it, but I wonder if it all ties into, you know, this idea of just being a little bit, it's not reserved. It's almost like, I should be careful. I don't know enough big words to
reserved sounds okay to me.
Yeah, okay. I'm trying. You're a scientist.
You know, I lived in Britain for 10 years, and I observed very similar things on a Saturday night in Britain. But I lived in Cardiff. Oh, geez, some pretty wild downtown scenes there. But by day, very conservative.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe we should jump back a little bit because we've jumped straight in. But I want to know, what's your way into this field? And again, I'm probably jumping over too many hoops, but if we go back a little bit, what was the dream for young Suresh? Did you think you would end up in this kind of scientific environment? Was that the plan for you?
No, I sort of I went to university, as people do, not really having any kind of plan. And I took a psychology paper. I thought, that's pretty interesting. And I took psychology papers. I think I started off more as an arts background, and I realized that biology was really, really interesting, and I gradually turned to more of a biological scientist. And so I studied neuroscience, which is the biology of how the brain works and generates our behavior. And that, so I drifted into that over the course of my university studies. I did a PhD at Auckland, and I went to the UK for 9 years and worked as a scientist there in quite a big institution. And there I started working in the area that I study, which is called psychopharmacology. It's understanding how drugs affect the brain and how it changes behavior, and how critically how we can measure not just that we see people altered, right? And we see people on an altered state of consciousness, like we say every Saturday night, but how we can potentially use our new science tools to actually measure what's happening in the brain. And when we can start to measure things, this is my spiel, then we can start to understand potentially how things can go wrong in disorders or how therapies work. So that's kind of the big game for me.
Yeah. And when you came across this, did you know that's the field you wanted to specialize in?
Well, you know, I drifted into doing this neuroscience stuff and the imaging, and then I realized, because I was trying to understand, as a scientist, and I was trying to understand why particular things were working in my data, and I couldn't, and I was struggling, we were trying to explain, it's kind of a boring topic, but we were trying to explain something in data, and then I realized, and I kind of drifted, one way to do it was to go in and manipulate the brain and pharmacologically. And so that's when I started doing drug studies early on in my science career to try to manipulate some of the signals I was seeing. And I've been doing that ever since. And that's how the psychedelic research that I got into started. So in my lab, we study all sorts of drugs, many boring anti-epileptic medications, things that no one are nowhere near as glamorous, for example, as studying LSD, but they're just as important.
And I mean, what's the latest things that you can reveal from your science? Because that's what a lot of people who don't go to science articles to read, you know, they're still stuck in their everyday life like me, and you just watch a bit of Game of Thrones, you go home, you try not to have a fight, and you go to sleep, you know? What's some things that you think are going to be game changers in the next kind of little while?
I think in the next, in the area I work, which is the brain and trying to understand how the brain works, in medicine since like the 1950s, doctors have been giving patients drugs to try to fix their central nervous systems, and it's somewhat effective, right? But the doctor who's trying to treat someone's brain, right, they're at a total disadvantage compared to a doctor who's fixing someone's cancer or fixing a skin or the heart. Because if you go into a cardiologist, they make measurements from your heart, and they can measure your pulse, and they do all these kind of scanning techniques, and they can actually measure, and they can give you a diagnosis based on what they're actually measuring. Now, for the longest time in psychiatry or neurology, we just weren't able to do that. In particular in psychiatry, there was no way of measuring anything from the brain. So it was kind of a hit and miss affair, and it still is about whether you hit the right treatment. But the latest thing I think in science is that we can do these imaging techniques. Now we're just starting to learn how to use them. We can start to make measurements. And when you can make measurements, then that can start to guide the way we give therapy. Mm. Then, you know, we're further along. And so instead of being random with how we do it, we can actually use sort of actual measures like all the other doctors do. And I'm not a medical doctor, I'm a scientist, but that's the kind of what we really want is to improve therapy by having actual measures that we can make. And hopefully, you know, in 10 or 15 years, when you've got a problem, you can go and get a scan, and at least they might not get the right medicine straight away, but improve the chances of you getting the right medicine.
It's so interesting, this idea, when you clarified I'm not a medical doctor, a scientist, because do you find yourself having to make statements like that just to make sure everyone knows your position? And what I mean by that is, I had my very first guest on the podcast was Professor Grant Schofield, and he wrote a book called What the Fat. It's about fat being good for you, you know, and I'm right into that because that makes sense to me. But he was talking about that he's taken a lot of hate from this. You know, there's people who are saying you are going to kill people with your stuff, with what you're saying. Is there this idea that because you're looking at it purely scientifically, you'll get others who look at it and say, you shouldn't even be testing this stuff, period?
Yeah, I mean, there is a responsibility when you're trying to say this sort of stuff. So, for example, you know, we're studying these particular drugs. People might have heard about the idea that you can take psychedelics as medicine, but I would never encourage anyone to do that back at home. Because that's just totally dangerous to do that.
That's the thing.
Like, to do it in an unsupervised environment, I mean, you could do yourself a lot of harm. When we do it in our studies, we have this really managed environment where we have medical doctors helping us out. And it's all very carefully done, and it's totally safe for our participants. So while it's a really interesting idea, you know, people shouldn't do this at home. This is like, these are experiments, and it's still a unknown quantity. So,
But do you think one day that it could be like you have your Botox clinic, your psychedelics clinic, and you would go there to, because the research says these help with specific things? And, you know, that term I'm using, specific things, again, I'll bank on, I'm just the everyday person. I don't know what that means. You're like, I assume, and maybe this is where I should ask the scientist, it's like I've got a problem, and maybe it's a childhood trauma or something. Mm-hmm. Trauma keeps coming up on the podcast. It's like this idea that a lot of the guests have had something horrific happen, but it's turned into their superpower, the reason they have an edge over someone else, and they're able to channel that. But a lot of people can't channel that, so this builds up in them. And I'm wondering if, like, this idea of, you know, the drug therapy or psychedelics or whatever you call it, if this is a way to unlock that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, could it be a therapy? Potentially, but only if the evidence says so. Only if, you know, the really good clinical trials haven't been done yet. That's for historical reasons we can get into later, why we don't know this stuff yet. But basically, the data's not out there to support that yet. But if it does go that way, and remember, when something gets approved as a medicine, there's two things, right? It has to work. You know, that's important. But it also has to not have side effects in too many people. So it's no good if a medicine fixes 10 people and one of them jumps off a bridge and kills himself. You know, so it has to be, it has to be thought of. So it's no, when people will often say anecdotes, oh, yeah, it fixed me. I took this myself and I'm fine. But for every one of those, or we don't know the numbers, right? There might be someone who has an adverse event, and it's really important that those adverse events. So it's a balancing act, right, of pros and cons. And then you have patient selection issues and stuff. So it's really complicated, right?
Oh, man, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to, like, start this conversation, you know? I mean, we're in it now and we're talking, and I'm constantly thinking, I don't know what we're talking about, but I do. You know, I know we're talking about the brain, and we're talking about essentially testing, you know, substances on people and seeing how they react and collecting the data. And then we can take that data, and the super smart brains like you read it, and we formulate it so general people can understand. And then you have to go down the road of, okay, now we've got to test it medically or something, and as long as everyone's happy, then we can maybe take it to the powers that be and say, this is why we should be changing to this because of these reasons. But, you know, when you guys are testing, is there an initial concept on what you're looking for?
So we, you know, things start off very exploratory.
So if I was your test subject, for example, and you come in, you know, 35-year-old, overweight, got some kids, I'm coming in, I'm sitting down, hello, Dr. Suresh, what are we up to today?
Well, you know, we have very specific studies, we have very specific aims when we do a study. We, you know, they don't come from thin air. You know, any of our studies, they're all based on, generally based on other studies that have been done. And so we're always trying to advance literature because we know a lot of stuff, and a lot of stuff has been done all around the world. And we, as scientists, we read it and we find interesting things and we find the stuff that's not known.
Right.
And so we're identifying the holes and the stuff in our understanding that we don't know. And so then we design an experiment to try to fill that gap in the knowledge. And that's kind of the key thing. Now, it just happened in the psychedelics world, of course, that there was massive holes in our literature and in our understanding, because we hadn't done any experiments like this as a society for 50 years.
So for 50 years, nothing.
Yeah, so I think the last sort of human experiments were in the sort of late 60s or 70s, and human research stopped. And there were a couple of very small, with LSD anyway, then there were a couple of very small studies done in the Switzerland in the 2000s. And then we did the first brain imaging study to actually try to...
New Zealand.
No, it was actually in the UK. I was working in Cardiff. So we collected all that data over there. And after the study was completed, I moved back to New Zealand. Actually, we did the last recording in Cardiff, and then the next day I was on a plane moving back to New Zealand.
Is that right?
And then it took us a year and a half to analyze that data set to turn it into papers.
Wow.
And because people get this idea that you just kind of give someone a drug, a picture comes up, you stick it in a paper, and it's like, no. You know, we spent probably a year getting the permissions to do the study, half a year to conduct the study, which was really quick because we knew I was leaving, so we had to do it really quickly in half a year.
Yeah.
And then a year and a half to analyze the data, and it's just all sitting behind a computer, crunching numbers, discussing things, trying to control things, being very compulsive about how you do it so that it's right.
Yeah.
So it's a long process. So, like,
man, it's long because, you know, exactly like you said, I'm thinking I'll roll in, or someone rolls in, you take something, and then what would happen if, so your subject that you're testing, are you, you know, putting lots of not trackers but testing type stuff?
So,
like you see in the movie.
What you see in the movie is kind of idealized. Some do a better job than others of representing.
What's a good movie that the general public?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
Okay.
There's one that I play my students in a second year paper. What's it called? It's called Salt. It's an Angelina Jolie movie.
Okay.
It's absolutely shocking.
Okay, sweet. So don't go.
It's really far from the truth. But most of the time, they're really far off. And what you're saying from the view of a participant is right? You know, the participant comes in, we do a couple of sessions. Like, so for a study, they might come in, we screen them and we make sure they're healthy. So a medical doctor will give you a full examination, make sure you're all good. Psychiatrist might interview you, do a whole bunch of tests and make sure that you're kind of going to be okay to be in our experiment, and you'll go home. And sometime later you'll come back in for the actual experiment. And, you know, you come in, you know, we'll spend thousands of dollars on each session because we have to book all the equipment that we need. It's not cheap. And we need to have, you know, there might be four scientists involved in pulling off a session and three big machines. You know, all of the stuff's got to come together. So the participant rolls in and they do the experiment. They leave again. And that's kind of it for them, you know. But we are doing this for, you know, 6 months and then dealing with the data for all that time.
Well, and everything's got to be right too. So
it has to be perfect.
And I'm imagining if you're dealing with like some type of substance, you have to create that perfectly. And then I don't know what research goes into that. Like if you're testing some type of certain chemical that's...
Yeah, it has to be produced. Yeah, so you have, the drug has to be manufactured properly at a pharmaceutical company to a specified standard so it's fit to put into a human. We can't just go down and...
You can't buy it from the street and say...
No, that's right. Not acceptable.
That's what people think. Well, that's what I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
well, maybe not to that level, but I'm like... How do you get it all done? I imagine you have to go to the police and say, look, man, police, we're doing this test and it's a controlled environment.
And yeah, there's licenses to, yeah, lots of licenses like to thing, lots of signing. You have to pay fees and get everybody on board. Yeah, so you need the company to make it to medicine standards, you know, so like how you expect the medicine to be made. And then all the regulatory bodies have to be, you have to get ethics to do it, ethical permission. Your university has to sign off on it and be happy that you're doing this experiment. Maybe your local health board as well. So there's a lot of, you know, people to all get on side. And critically, you have to fund it because it's not cheap and you need money to do it.
And are there lots of people funding these type of things? Because I would like to think, you know, there's the philanthropists out there who are like looking to the future and how we can be happier and better as humans, and you know what I mean? I mean, where's the funding coming from?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So typically in science, you know, I'll write a grant application to a governmental organization to try to get funding to do this piece of science. Now, there hasn't been very much government, you know, you can imagine we're trying to extend this to a, you know.
Oh, it's the weed guys again.
Yeah. And, you know, that is maybe starting to change. But so most of this research, like you're implying, is often funded philanthropically. The research that we did was funded philanthropically. And I'll throw this out there, but if there's any listeners out there that are really wealthy and would like to give us some philanthropic funding, then we wouldn't protest. But in all seriousness, that's how this research was funded. Amanda Fielding, who runs the Beckley Foundation, put money into getting this done. And there are a few other philanthropists out there who are interested in advancing this area of research. And they give research grants essentially to fund the research. That said, like the research group in the UK, David Nutt's research group, they've now got an MRC grant, a Medical Research Council of UK grant, to study psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms. So that was a governmental grant given to them. So
in here?
No, that's in Britain.
That's not happening in New Zealand at the moment.
You know, there's no I don't see that happening in New Zealand.
Is it too out there for our culture?
I'm not sure. New Zealand's quite small. You know, if you think about it, the size of the country is only 1/20th of the thing. So there's just not as much variation, and not every piece of research is being done in a very small country. Yeah. Whereas in the UK, it's a lot larger, so there's a lot more niche areas that can be filled. So, yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's interesting because maybe it's and I guess the research will prove everything, you know, going forward. And like you're saying, this isn't short term. These are long term things. Like you were talking about, half a year to get something done. You know, these are timelines.
Well, or 3 years. Start to finish, 3 years. Yeah. That project.
And it might be that no findings were made, but you are adding to an existing catalogue of work. That when the next scientist comes along, they did this, this, and this. But did they think about that? And I guess the thing
that's exactly how the process works.
Okay.
That's exactly it.
That's so awesome.
And, you know, we do it often. It'll be us doing it again. Like, we'll go, oh, we didn't think about that.
Right.
Maybe if we do it this way, we can solve that little problem we didn't quite solve.
You do the best you can do. And I think people understand that. And that's what I try and get across on the podcast. And that's what I'm exploring. This is my own research in a way, to see how does your mind process the world, the things you've learned and you can express. Then I can pick that up. I can take some of that. The audience can do it. And what I like is that it's all for free. People download it. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no transaction there. So in effect, the experiment is real in terms of podcasting and the internet and sharing ideas? And then how does this work as a society going forward? Like, I wonder if the next generation of rule makers who create the rules and say, yes, we're going to put more money into that, maybe they're listening right now. Do you know what I mean? And it all happens because we're brave enough to talk about these things. And it really captured my imagination, this idea that, and I'm ripping it off a Will Smith movie, I will not lie, it's the Concussion film, and he says something in the, to the effect of, history remembers, you know? So what I like is you could quite easily say, I don't want any part of that kind of study because that's going to go on my CV and people might judge me for that. And I reckon that would be quite common when you go down a medical path or a scientific path. Surely there's, you know, looking for life on Mars, any of the plethora of things that humans need. But I like that I get to talk to someone like yourself who's maybe, and maybe for you, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you break it down very scientific. So you're like, it doesn't matter what the drug is, it's just a series of chemicals that I'm testing to find a solution. I mean, do these things, like, yeah, you know what I mean?
What you're saying resonates. And I don't like, you know, I'm not trying to be the psychedelic guy. You know, it's just a piece of work that I do as part of my scientific exploration of trying to do stuff. And unlike some people, I'm not very evangelical about psychedelics at all. I'm a very hard-nosed kind of scientist. But what you said is there is a risk, or at least a perceived risk, that if you're a scientist doing that kind of thing, that, or this kind of research, that you might be sort of perceived in a sort of kind of suspicious light, or is that really like sort of okay science, or is, you know, and that's one of the things I'm particularly proud of in the work that we did. We did something that was really rigorous, like it wasn't sloppy science at all, and it's in, for us, it's in a really top scientific journal, and went through all the correct peer review, and we did a really good experiment. I'm not sort of embarrassed or whatever, you know, I think that we did a really good experiment. And if I showed any of my colleagues what we did and they read the paper, all the media aside, that's actually a really kind of top-notch piece of science. But there is a, you know, I think that kind of fear of kind of stigmatization, sort of stigmatization for studying that does exist. But hopefully as more work like this happens, that stigmatization comes, sort of starts to drop a little bit. Professor David Nutt from the UK, who's kind of, I was working with, he was very inspirational about sort of that scientists kind of shouldn't be sort of constrained by those kind of things and sort of should have a freedom to express and do the kind of work they want, because that's kind of almost what the science demands that we do.
Exactly.
So he was quite an inspirational kind of guy to me.
Well, it's amazing to hear you speak like that too, because again, myself and maybe a few people listening, and I said to you before the podcast, we don't mingle, and I don't mingle in scientist circles. So it's like amazing that I get to ask every dumb question, and because I have a microphone, you're like, all right, this dude's on the street, so I've, you know, you kind of like have to put up with it in a professional way. But I feel like that's what people want to ask, you know. And when you express the things and talk about these real life things that you're kind of working through, it's just good. It's good. I'm convinced that that's the way we move forward. It's just through conversation. We're built to talk. We just don't do it anymore. We write, we email, we Facebook, and it's all a part of us that's kind of right, but there's nothing like us sitting down and just talking. And, you know, it's very uncommon, which, I don't know, we need to change that. The research you're talking about, the article that got in the top scientific journal, what was that specifically?
So that was our brain imaging study of LSD that we did, which I've kind of alluded to.
Yeah. But was there a big finding that kind of captured it for you, or was it just a series?
So it was kind of – there were two things. There was that it was – in some ways it was socially – groundbreaking that we could do this study at long last. And that was like quite a sort of big step forward, I think. But actually, scientifically, there's some really interesting results in there, and it gets a bit kind of nerdy at times.
Perfect. I can see you loving it, though.
But yeah, and so we really found some really interesting things by doing the study. And they not only tell us about the drug, but they also, when the reason of people are, why do you study this drug? The thing is, you can manipulate consciousness, and you can manipulate the way people are, or you can manipulate the chemicals, and then you can see how it changes them. And then when you can see how it changes them, you can start to infer what processes are involved in normal consciousness.
Right.
So I'll tell you an example, right? So what we found was that we were studying how the visual cortex, how it connects to other parts of the brain, right? And what we found was that after a person had taken LSD, that, or had been administered LSD rather, that the visual part of the brain that does visual cortex starts to connect up with all these other parts of the brain that it is only weakly connected to normally. So it starts to, the inference is that we start to send and receive more information, and that's with, and that correlated with the amount of hallucinations people have. So, and you can think about it normally, right? The brain, part of the visual cortex is doing vision. In order for it to do that well, it doesn't need to be getting too much other kind of junky input from the rest of the brain, because it's just going to confuse it. But LSD kind of broke down those barriers a bit, and it starts to receive all the stuff it shouldn't get.
Wow.
And that's why the mechanism behind the hallucination. So not only does it tell us about the drug, but it tells us how the normal state of things is, that there's a kind of balance in how the visual cortex is connected to other part of the cortex to maintain healthy, normal vision. Mm. Otherwise, things will fall apart on you.
Wow.
Jeez. And the walls will start bleeding, and motion will start happening when it's not actually there.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I thought that was a really one of our many interesting findings.
Yeah. I mean, people can go read the article for free, right?
They can read it, and it is for free, but it's not very accessible.
Okay.
You know, it's very technical.
You should, like, read it, but then break down in regular terms what that means.
Yeah, so there is the original article, but there have been articles written about it.
Okay. Where's the best place to Google?
Probably I think there was an article in The Guardian that was quite good. There's also, I think, one in New Scientist. Depending on how technically kind of readership you want to be. But yes, a New Scientist is a little bit more technical, Guardian a bit more kind of mainstream. Yeah. So there are kind of some decent, I think probably those are the two I would go to.
Awesome. Suresh, this podcast is, you know, developing as we go, and it's kind of like its own social experiment. But the tagline I kind of came up with is there a missing link to being happy? You know, like, I think generally we live in this rat race, we live in a zoo, and we either live in a zoo that's good for us, or we live in a horrible one, like the zoos were 30 years ago, concrete flooring, which I think is what our society is at the moment. You know, it doesn't value bush and looking in long distances and feeling wind. It values getting from A to B quick, and doesn't matter what's happening up here. It's all about the outside. So my hope is, and this is just a gut feeling, and I don't know what your thoughts on it, is that things like psychedelics and drugs, even though I've never really tried them, this is what my gut's telling me, that they're that missing link, you know, used correctly in an environment where I can go see my psychiatrist. That's what that level of control, you know, where it will be part of a toolkit to say, okay, William, what's happening in your life? And when you're saying it's connecting something in the eyes that we can see more, maybe I'm trying to connect that in my head when I'm thinking about stuff, I'm able to think more. Do you know what I mean? And then when you're out of that experience, that maybe you have a bigger scope on what's going on, meaning your decisions change, and that the rat race of getting from A to B, you can't not see that for being what it is, which is bad for us anymore. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? And I'm probably terrible putting a scientist in that position, because I'm asking you to talk through feelings, not through research.
Yeah. Well, you know, what you're saying is a kind of a viewpoint that certain psychotherapists who are interested in these drugs kind of, that they might have this kind of property, that could potentially be harnessed. And that's certainly a question. And for me as a scientist, I would try to evaluate the kind of the validity of that. It's a big unknown because these drugs, as a biologist, right, they work on particular systems in the brain, and it's not entirely clear that there couldn't be other compounds or other ways you could use them to manipulate the same systems and actually have less dramatic effects on someone's overt consciousness, but couldn't actually kind of slowly fix them.
I see.
We just don't know, but the research has just not been done.
But I guess the general feeling would be more research needed, meaning let's pump money into this and just keep testing.
Right? Yeah, we really do need to do more research. And, you know, in New Zealand, we have a really bad record of doing research in mental health. We probably don't put as much money into actually treating mental health as we should. And we certainly don't do enough research into how we can fix it and fix it when things go wrong. That's probably globally true, but New Zealand, from my observation, I've only been back a year or two, we do a pretty bad job of making progress in there. We do a wonderful job in other areas of health, like things like cancer. We're all over that, you know. And I know that we are making some progress in opening up about, you know, that we have mental health problems, but we're still, you know, when you look at other areas of medicine where we are all over it and we're really, you know, good about it, there's, you know, in mental health, we just haven't, it's just so far behind. I don't know what the solution to it is, but it is a issue because it's such a big health problem for our society.
Well, I think part of the problem might be that we just don't acknowledge and talk about it. So what I do know is that me and you talking right now matters, you know? It matters because if we don't acknowledge the problem, you're basically saying you don't have a problem. So if enough people are talking about it, then it gets on the radar. And then, you know, like we're saying, history remembers, and we'll remember back when no one cared properly about mental health.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of mental health, though, do you know, that's the tie-in, the reason.
Or brain health.
Brain health.
Brain health. Yeah, that's the way I see it, brain health.
Yeah, but, yeah. Which is, you know, arguably the whole reason I'm doing this, because I'm just trying to understand what makes us tick, you know, and what's the through line that someone from your profession and, you know, other people I've had, the things we all agree on, you know, that's the things I'm really looking for. But, you know, I'm hearing from you, it's about testing these things and testing again and trying to get the best results and then taking those results in, maybe then the change is happening. The final thing I ask every guest is to just like take a step back, have a look at everything that's going on around us. What's your kind of view on the way things are, and what I mean specifically is what's your meaning to everything?
To be honest, at this point in my life with two little kids snapping at my heels, I just try to get through day to day. I try to do a good job of my work and a good job of looking after my family, and that's sort of it, really. I think that's really no different to most people, right?
Exactly. But you said it out loud, and no one now can go away thinking the scientist thinks the science. You know what I mean? It's that you are you, and you expressed what you think, and that's the perfect answer. Suresh, thank you for joining me, man.
No problem.
You're a great guest.
So that's us for another week, friends. I'd like to say thank you to Dr. Suresh Muthukumaraswamy for making time. He's busy. He's got a clinic to run. Well, he's doing scientific experiments. He's got family, all that stuff. But to carve out some of that time for a conversation – you know, where there is no agenda. It's just a conversation. I feel like he's part of the people who are letting us know it's all okay to do that. All right. There doesn't have to be that you need a certain amount of likes or, you know, that instant payoff. This is good for us just to talk. I'd like to thank Podcasts NZ, Podcasts New Zealand, for supporting the podcast of My Kiwi Life, Paul Spain and the crew, awesome fellas and ladies and all parties involved. I'd like to thank you guys who join me every week. This is awesome. If you haven't checked out my vlog, maybe jump over to YouTube, search The Will Fleming Vlog, F-L-E-M-I-N-G, and check out what I get up to every day. I'm just trying to find my way with it. I'm in this very creative zone. My Kiwi Life is part of that. The vlog is part of that. And I just really am pushing to have fun every day and, you know, exercise my brain in terms of conversation. I feel like that's worth investing in. So that you guys join me in that is really cool, because I think this is an investment for us all. All right, folks, hope everyone is doing well. If you're not, reach out to someone. If you are, maybe reach out to someone who isn't. Give everyone a high five. Hugs to you all. Thank you, guys.
Whoa, this is my